The child is crying. Do something for the child first.
Kesey says nothing. His eyes are shut tight. The high keening sound rises from the circle with the kid's scream weaving through it. Fantastic mind power crackle. Gold Hill registers the energy. They're almost. But the girl on the side doesn't let up.
See about the child. A child is crying. That's all that's happening. A child is crying, and no one is doing anything about it.
Almost have it. Prescovue.
Why is the child crying? Doesn't anybody care?
Feel it, the vibration level. Kesey looks up. The spot hits him in the face. The pranksters release hands. The music starts up. The anonymous artists of America play a low rock and roll version of Pomp and Circumstance with drum flourishes. The acid test graduation. By now the crowd is down to about 50. The lights come up a little around the stage, but the rest of the garage is dark. Cassidy is up on stage in front of a microphone. He has on nothing but a pair of khakis hung down on his hips and a mortarboard hat on his head, the kind you graduate in. In one hand, he has a whole stack of diplomas. He's wound up like a motorcycle, kicking and twitching and ticking and jerking at the knees, the elbows, the head. He's off on a dazzling run of words. The anonymous artists of America keeps rolling away behind him. Every time the little blonde girl on the drums gives the drums a good swat, Cassidy stiffens, a spasmodic jerk, as if somebody just kicked him in the small of the back. He's rapping away. He's handing out the diplomas for the acid test graduation. It's coming off after all. Now, when? What the hell time is it? 5 o'clock in the morning, or who the hell knows? Kesey is in the dimness, sunk into the great easy chair. Some of the graduates are here, pranksters mainly. They put on black caps and gowns and come bouncing up to the stage and get a diploma from Cassidy. Scrolly, convoluted things done by Paul Foster and the God Rotor. Gut, the Hell's Angel, lets out a whoop and does a little dance, as his name is called. Many of the graduates aren't there. The Who Cares Girl. The Who Cares Girl, says Cassidy. Now, the Who Cares Girl couldn't be with us this evening, you understand. Had to check in for choir practice in the oat bin, 200 fine voices tuned to a split hair, screaming the name of the cowboy known as Ray, you understand. Couldn't be with us either. Lost in a Band-Aid factory, swabbing the Jake seats with A200. And the drums roll, and Cassidy stiffens and jerks and twitches, and the pranksters hasten forward. Hassler, Babs, Zonker, the Hermit, Mountain Girl, Gretch, Paul Foster, Black Mariah, Page, Walker, Hagen, Doris DeLay, Roy Seaburn, flying up and back in black robes. Graduate. Into what on the horizon, as the light of dawn breaks through the crack in the garage door behind the bandstand? Those cold, goddamn silver slivers. And the light rises in the garage, a cockroach-orange dimness. And there is perfect silence, the world stroked out this way and that as in lucite. And the heat of the day creeps in, and rising out of the funk and the musk and the rat grease smears, now come the cinches, mites, crab lice, fleas, fruit flies, grubs, weevils, all the microbes and larval ooze, and start writhing and crawling and festering and frying and wriggling and sizzling. The straight world breathes in, coughs, gags, spaghetti trapped in every glottis and flapping in panic. Back among the acid heads of San Francisco, there were two or three days of post-mortems after the collapse of the prankster Winterland fantasy and the strange night in the garage. A little breast-beating here and there. Oh, did we give in to fear and doubts, which a good head cannot afford and thereby stop a brave cat from doing his thing? But just as many said, Kesey was out to freak us out or cop out on us, and it was just as well. And then the communal mind, not willing to be anti-freak-out, settled on the cop-out theory of it. Kesey had been just copping out all along to keep from going to jail. That settled something else, too, the troublesome, souped-up thing the pranksters were always into, this 400-horsepower takeoff game, this American flag-flying game. This Dayglo game, this yay-saying game, this Dread Neon game, this superhero game, all wired up and wound up and amplified in the electro-pastel chrome game gleam. It wasn't the Buddha, not for a moment. Life is shit, said the Buddha, a duress of bad karmas, and Satori is passive, just lying back and grooving and grokking on the Overmind, and leave Teddy Roosevelt out of it. Grace is in a far country, India by name. Oh, the art of living in India, brothers. And so what if there is no plumbing and the streets are dirty? They have mastered the art of living. The pranksters had cleared all their debris out of the garage before the Calliope Company had moved back in, and they had piled it up in the vacant lot next door, and then they headed off to Bab's old place, the Spread in Santa Cruz. The prankster debris lay there in the lot, a vast, weird junk heap of bits and pieces of costumes and masks and pieces of wood with day-glow paint all over them, and weird signs painted in day-glow on swathes of butcher paper, and it lay there writhing like a maniac all day, and at night, it glowed. A blot on the escutcheon of Harriet Street. The neighbors there, industrious Japanese and others, were disadvantaged souls, but they had their pride and they formed a delegation to City Hall to insist on keeping their neighborhood clean. The mayor's office saw it as an example of the kind of neighborhood pride that regenerates the city. For if they could instill the good burger spirit in even so lowly a neighborhood as the Tenderloin. So the mayor announced utmost cooperation, and it became a regular ceremony with officials showing up along with the Senate men and the TV crews. And the city pitched in, joining forces with the good neighbors of Harriet Street, in the ceremonial destruction of the weird junk heap. Christ only knew what insane degenerate wino generations had combined to nearly take over this poor forgotten street like jungle rot. The day-glow paint sputtered and sizzled to the end. The Calliope Company held an acid test in the garage, and Cassidy, wheeling around San Francisco in his latest car, heard about it somehow and showed up that night. He came in the doorway on the Harriet Street side, now marked 69 Harriet Street, after the humor of the times, and he was jerking and kicking at top speed to the unseen Joe Cuba. He was sailing on speed, as 30 or 40 heads there could tell by the way his eyes jumped around, going tick-tack, tock-tock-tock, tack-tock, tack-tock, tick-tick-tick-tick-tick, tack-tock, tack-tock, tick-tick-tick-tick-tick, tock-tack, tock-tack, tock-tack. Either that or he was amazed at this acid test through and through. There were no lights except the slowest and most fluid light projections, no noise except the most mellifluous hi-fi playing. What the fuck? Sitar? 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 The garage was scrubbed and chased and pure, with wall hangings of the most meticulous sort, India print coverlets, delicate and intricate, of pure vegetable macrobiotic dyes. A few crystals in the air picked up rays of light one by one like jewels. And all the good heads were stroked out most silently, propped up sitting against the walls or stretched out, each grooving on his own private inward thing, receptacles of the Buddha, the all-one invited guest. And the Buddha could have walked in at any moment and felt right at home, 485 B.C., or right now, the dead-ass little gook. Cassidy can't believe it. He is rapping a mile a minute, but nobody picks him up on it. They just stare up at him through great amethyst eyes full of tolerance and pity as his own eyes sprocket and his shoulders bob and weave. Hey! Don't you want to do anything? Get it started, you understand? Slide it around. They just stare at him, peaceful, luminescent, violet, jewel children, smiling like a bunch of freaking nuns full of peace and tolerance and pity. As he turns around, shaking his head and his shoulders, and kicking and flailing, disappearing out onto Harriet Street again. Oh, Christ, another little bud in the heaves and gases of the discovery pangs. Her eyes are opened up like morning glories, her lips are wet and glistening, she smiles like an entranced nun, her teeth are beginning to sizzle. Hold on to the thoracic box. She has her face right up in yours, everybody's, and she is saying, ecstatic with the discovery,
I'm getting the picture. We're all here, right? We're all here. We're here.
And her hand pans around to take in the fantasia in the beginning cosmos, which is, in fact, only a place known as the Barn in Scotts Valley, 10 miles from Santa Cruz. The Barn is Scotts Valley's first psychedelic night spot, a great barn, truly, once converted into a theater, and now into a psychedelic night spot run by Leon Tabori, Scotts Valley's first and last, to hear the grousing from the church down the way, and the local constables and town folk and the local paper, but never mind all that. To the little girl, it's her first glimpse of heaven itself, zonked as she is on LSD, her first capsule.
I'm getting the picture. We're all here, and we can do anything we want.
Revealing all this to Doris DeLay and Zonker, Doris, like a good old helpful hand, says,
That's right. We're all here, and everything's all right, and you're fine.
The little bud sinks into a folding chair beside Doris's and gives her a look.
I should be suspicious of you.
The paranoia stage, Doris says to Zonker. I love to tell the story.
Because I'm stoned.
I know, says Doris. To tell the old, old story, Love and Glory now playing in your neighborhood for the first run in Scotts Valley. About 80 of the local heads and hip folk and jazz buffs, etc., in here listening to a jazz trio called the New Dimensions, Dave Molinari, Andrew Shushkoff, and a stocky little guy playing the bass. The little guy has on a sporty-type hat, wears it while he plays, his signature, you understand, and a pair of Cuban wraparound sunglasses, although it is dark and appropriately nightclubby, except for some light projections which makes it psychedelic. And he is kneading and flapping and flummoxing the bass like the creamy days of Slam Stewart. The New Dimensions. Now that's very funny, you know. Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters have to smile over that. Kesey and the Pranksters are off to one side of the barn waiting for their turn to go on, setting up their instruments, the electric guitars and basses, Gretsch's Hammond organ, Walker's drums, and the goddamnedest gleaming heap of wires, dials, amplifiers, speakers, headsets, mics, testing. The New Dimensions, yeah. The trio is like a throwback to the late 1940s and the early 1950s when jazz was like the final form, funky and so fine. Molinari, or is it Shushkoff, goes into a hell of a riff, oh Christ, remember, on the piano, with his head dug down deep into the profound soul funky depth of this thing. It's so, well, nostalgic. Scotts Valley troops into post-World War II hip America. The Pranksters have their own speakers set up all over the barn, and Babs is trying to test the microphones, watching for the needle to jump over the dials. Babs has on his Day-Glow spirit mask, and it glows in the dark, also a Shazam shirt and pants of many stripes and colors, and he blows into the microphones, then hums a bit and watches the needles, then keens a bit, then croons a bit, and that's nice, so he tries a little ululation, and that's nicer. And pretty soon he is keening and gooning along with the New Dimensions, and his voice sails through their sound like a stoned ghost on the airwaves. Kesey sits on a folding chair in the control center testing the headsets. Cassidy has the Raptar, now painted an infinite number of colors and totally without strings. Doris DeLay plays Kindly Aunt with the zonked-out little girl who's getting the picture. The New Dimensions finish their set and they're mad as hell, of course. What cube was doing that screaming bit, for Christ's sake? The three of them come stomping up to the likely suspects, the Pranksters, led by the stocky guy with the hat and sunglasses. He walks up to Babs and says, Like, I mean, who's doing all that?
Doing what? Says Babs.
Like, later, man, don't give me the doing what bit. You know doing what, man. I mean, like,
was somebody doing something?
Like, I mean, that's later. You know, I mean, it grates.
Oh, you mean that funny noise? I'd say feedback.
Sure, feedback.
Yeah, right.
Just a parlor sport, this is. Fella could do it with his left hand. The little guy is furious. He tries to find the words to express his utter loathing. Like, man, this fuck-up bit on somebody else's set, it's so... square! There, he said it, the worst insult he knows. Next, the fire next time. Kesey steps in as the peacemaker.
He wasn't working against you, he was trying to play with you.
The little guy stares at Kesey but doesn't say anything. He just screams it again into the void.
Like it's so... square!
Yeah, right, says Babs. And there's the guy who did it. And he points at Cool Breeze, who is sitting at a little table with a candle on it, hunched over a piece of paper, doing some kind of intense meth-like drawing. There he goes, says Cassidy, picking up on the thing. Takes a phantom heart to catch a Cool Breeze, you understand. And so forth and so on, a shuck, in a word, never trust a prankster. And the New Dimensions walk off, disgusted. They refuse to play anymore and start packing up their instruments, which leaves Tabori, the barn's manager, in a bind. He can't figure out who the hell to alienate. Kesey is a giant. On the other hand, the New Dimensions can play. But too late for all that. The New Dimensions stomp out, thumbing their noses at the whole scene. The pranksters wind up for their set. They clamp on their headsets. The headsets are wired up to a variable lag system. So the pranksters don't hear what they are playing right now, but what they were playing a second ago. They harmonize off themselves, break up all learned progressions, and only they can hear the full orchestration. A symphony in their own cortices, the music of the prankster. Only the kids in the barn can't figure out what's going on. It's like, weird. The pranksters put on their headsets and pick up their instruments, Keezy on an electric guitar, Paige on an electric guitar, also Hassler, Babs on an electric bass, Gretsch on the electric organ, George Walker on the drums. They look all ready to go, but nothing happens. They're waiting for the energy to build up, to come crackling over the headsets, the spontaneous burst, but nothing works. Somebody starts and nobody else can pick it up, and soon it's obvious that none of these crazy-looking people is going to play the instruments except for the drummer. And they're not playing songs, they make it up as they go along. The leader, the muscular guy, Keezy, singing, "It's a road map that ought to have been issued about how to reach the edge of time on a horse who flies in tungsten red." And the guy in the mask on the bass singing, "Floods of screams on the beach in bomby raids of bloody rainbows. It's dark and I lose my vision." Well, the kids start leaving. What the hell? Babs belches over a microphone. That gets a laugh. But is it art? Keezy barks like a dog. George Walker says over his microphone, "Where'd that dog go? I heard a dog under my very feet." They slough to a halt. Hassler starts chanting into his microphone, which is wired in only to the headsets. Only prankster ears can hear. "Begin it like we began, at the beginning. Do it like we did, at the beginning. In the beginning, in the beginning." Chanting over the inner space network. But the slump and the slough are total. The kids all going in droves now, just the pranksters left. An atmosphere of total tedium. It's all too much for mortal. Even prankster is drifting off, leaving the main floor, going downstairs. Hagen shakes his head. It's like a wake. It's that burnt-out husk of the dark hours of the morning. Black Mariah finds a mattress in a utility room and lies down. Cassidy, not high at all, low in fact, offers to drive a girl home. Now it's just Keezy on the electric guitar and Babs on the electric bass, them and their headsets picking up the sound of their instruments and their song in variable lag. Taburi himself, the manager, can't take it anymore. "Just shut the door tight when you leave," he tells Keezy, and he takes off. All the lights are out now, just a little glow from the dials of Prankster Control Central. Keezy and Babs have their eyes closed, strumming slowly. Alone in the center of the vast gloom of the barn. The whole world contracts, draws closer and deeper, and crawls inside the headsets, ricocheting in variable lag in the small hours, and Keezy sings over his guitar, which twangs and wobbles. And every now and then, you can hear her blowing smoke rings around a cloud and trying to lace up her shoe. And Babs. And the message goes out, and it breaks out just a little bit, but stops. And Keezy. It's kind of hard playing cello on a hypodermic needle and using a petrified bat as a bow. And Babs. Yes, it's hard working with these materials without the grins falling off your knees. And Keezy. And the soldiers think of the lowly fleas. And the latrines wade back up around my knees. So let's sit here in this dilapidated people hutch and think about the things we've done. Yes. Down in Mississippi, that bitch girl we diddled in the cotton field. Still, you want to catch the first subway to heaven. If I can get myself a new set of scales, I'll get my ass off this third rail. And so saying, he stood up and retched and looked down on the rail on sparks and long and hairy slavers of various flavors of dark intestinal brown. And his teeth fell out by the dozen, and Hitler and his infested cousins began to grow in the cellar like a new hybrid corn, and the crows wouldn't touch him. And up on the rail, old True Blue wiped his nose on his uncle's clothes. I took some suloban and one long diddle. We blew it! 10,000 times or more. We blew it! So much we can't keep score. We blew it! Just when you're beginning to think I'm going to score. We blew it!
But there's more in store. We blew it! If we can get rid of these trading stamps that get in the way of the merchandise. We blew it! 10 million times or more. We blew it! It was perfect. So what do? We blew it! Perfect. We blew it!
Epilogue. 3 weeks later, November 30th, Kesey went on trial in San Francisco for possession of marijuana. The bust on the rooftop. It ended with a hung jury split 8-4 against him. Kesey's retrial in April ended with another hung jury, 11-1 against him this time. Rather than try him again, however, the state let him plead nolo contendere to a lesser charge, knowingly being in a place where marijuana was kept. He got 90 days. In May, he lost in his appeal of the original San Mateo County conviction for possession of marijuana, the La Honda bust. The sentence was 6 months on a county work farm, a $1,500 fine, and 3 years probation. He was allowed to serve the other sentence, the 90 days, concurrently. Before he started serving time, Kesey took the bus and headed for his hometown, Springfield, Oregon, with just Faye and the kids and Ramrod on board. The pranksters pretty much scattered. George Walker and Cassidy were off in Mexico. Mountain Girl, with her baby, Sunshine, had already joined the Grateful Dead's group. Black Mariah and Paul Foster went to the hog farm, Hugh Romney's commune near Los Angeles. Babs and Gretch went to San Francisco. So did the Hermit. In June, Kesey began his stretch on the work farm, which was just a few miles from his old place in La Honda. He worked in the tailor shop. He was let out last November, after serving 5 months. He went back to Oregon, and he and Faye set up house in a shed on his brother Chuck's farm, up a gravel road south of Springfield. The shed was called the Space Heater House, after a gas heater inside that gave off a jet flame when it lit up. In February, Neil Cassidy's body was found beside a railroad track outside the town of San Miguel de Allende in Mexico. Some local Americans said he had been going at top speed for 2 weeks and had headed off down the railroad track one night and his heart just gave out. Others said he had been despondent and felt that he was growing old and had been on a long downer and had made the mistake of drinking alcohol on top of barbiturates. His body was cremated. In the spring, various pranksters, Babs and Gretch, George Walker, Mike Hagan, Hassler, Black Mariah, began finding their way to Oregon from time to time. The bus was there, parked beside the Space Heater House. Kesey was writing again, working on a novel. Author's note. A note on the writing of this book. I have tried not only to tell what the pranksters did, but to recreate the mental atmosphere or subjective reality of it. I don't think their adventure can be understood without that. All the events, details, and dialogue I have recorded are either what I saw and heard myself, or were told to me by people who were there themselves, or were recorded on tapes or film or in writing. I was fortunate to get the help of many unusually talented and articulate people, most notably Ken Kesey himself. The pranksters recorded much of their own history in the prankster archives in the form of tapes, diaries, letters, photographs, and the 40-hour movie of the bus trip. Kesey was also generous enough to allow me to draw from his letters to Larry McMurtry in the chapters on his flight to Mexico. Much of the dialogue and italicized material in chapters 21 and 22 is quoted from these letters. For all the pranksters, as I have tried to show, the events described in this book were both a group adventure and a personal exploration. Many achieved great insight on both levels. I can think back especially to my talks with Mountain Girl, Hassler, Black Mariah, Stuart Brand, Ken Babs, Paige Browning, Mike Hagan, Doris DeLay, Hugh Romney, Zonker, George Walker, and Neil Cassidy. Sandy Lehman Haupt told me about his prankster days in especially full and penetrating detail. There were several excellent writers in addition to Kesey who were involved in the prankster saga. Playwright Norman Hartweg recounted his experiences for me in a series of tapes. Edward McClanahan provided me with information about several phases of the prankster adventure, and Robert Stone told me a great deal about Kesey's fugitive days in Mexico. I was also fortunate to find people like Claire Brush,
who wrote for me a 3,000-word description of her experience at the Watts acid test, much of which I quote in describing the test. Of the many other people I talked to or corresponded with, I particularly want to mention Vic Lovell, Paul Sawyer, Paul Krasner, Pat Hallinan, Brian Rowan, Paul Robertson, Jerry Garcia, Gary Goldhill, Michael Bowen, Ann Severson, Paul Hawken, Bill Tara, Michael Layton, Jack the Fluke, Bill Graham, John Bartholomew Tucker, Roger Grimsby, Marshall Efron, Robin White, Larry McMurtry, Larry Schiller, Donovan Bess, Carl Lehman Haupt, and Mr. and Mrs. Fred Kesey. This concludes the reading of The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe. This book was read by Michael Pritchard. Additional titles by Tom Wolfe in the Books on Tape Library include The Bonfire of the Vanities, From Bauhaus to Our House, The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamlined Baby, The Purple Decades, and The Right Stuff. For additional information about them or for help with topics of related interest, please call our customer service department or check our catalog index to find review material.